Hi folks, Neil Bailey here. This is an interview I conducted with Jen Van Meter, and it's with regards to the Black Lightning miniseries, which very prominently features Superman and tells the story of a great family drama. I sat down with Jen and asked her a whole bunch of questions. It's a nice long interview, one of the best I've had the pleasure of being at. She did all the work, thankfully. I blew the introduction, which is why you're hearing this caveat here. So it starts a little bit abruptly. It should be known that this is wholly my fault. But anyway, let's get on with the show. First off, let's familiarize folks with who you are and what you do. I know, but other folks may not. What is your history as a writer? What's some of the stuff you've done?
Well, most people who know my work know the Hopeless Savages miniseries, series of miniseries that I've done with Oni Press. That's a creator-owned project that follows a family that started with the premise of what if Sid and Nancy had not died tragically, but had in fact raised up a brood of rascally children.
It's awesome.
So that series is the thing I have done the most of. I've also done I did an Elseworlds for DC Comics called The Golden Streets of Gotham. That was my first big thing for them. I did a couple short stories for Flinch and Weird Western Tales and things like that when those were running. I did a JSA classified arc called Honor Among Thieves that I was very pleased with and that got some nice reviews.
That was awesome as well.
Thank you. I've done some fill-in stuff for Outsiders. I've done
Cinnamon, right?
Yeah, Cinnamon El Ciclo is a miniseries that about a young woman who is named after Cinnamon 1. She in the DC Encyclopedia, she's listed as Cinnamon 2, which was very exciting to me. I wrote something that made it into that encyclopedia. It was a hoot. So that, and then little bits and pieces here and there other than that.
Cool. Well, let's see. What does this Black Lightning project mean to you as a character? What initially drew you to the project? What started it?
What started it was, so I was at a convention in Toronto, I think it was, and I saw Dan DiDio, and he said he wanted to have coffee with me, and he wanted me to pitch something for him, and I thought that he meant go away, come back, meet me for coffee, and pitch something. So I went away, and prepared for myself a little pitch about Aquaman. And I should say I didn't have to prepare much because I've been pitching Aquaman forever. But I put together something, and then I met him, and I sort of rolled right into it. I said, okay, so here's the thing, Dan. And I told him my little pitch, and he looked at me, and he said, why are you pitching at me? And I said, you told me to. And he said, no, I have something I want you to pitch. And I said, okay, do you still want me to? And he said, yes, which was good. And what he was asking, he said, we're doing these year ones, and I want to do a Black Lightning. What do you know about the character? And I told him what I knew, which was mostly his recenter continuity. I said, you know, I've read some of his older stuff when he was on The Outsiders and stuff, but this is what I know. And he said, I want you to go away, see if you can find some of the original material, read it, and come back and tell me what you do. And so I did. And what I saw was this guy with this really great internal strength. I felt like, you know, it's a superhero comic book, so it has to have a lot of fists flying around. That's sort of the convention, right? There's a bad guy, and you use force to stop it. And yet, I felt like there was an awful lot going on inside the guy that was really compelling. You know, the very first thing I ever read of him was that I can remember at that time, and still I don't remember seeing anything of this before, but I think it's in Batman and the Outsiders number one, which would have been, I guess, mid-80s?
Yeah, I think, like, 87?
Whenever that came out, I remember reading it, and Jeff shows up, and he's in civilian clothes, he's in street clothes, and he's thinking about some near miss or something that has happened that has made him feel responsible for somebody's death. He's got blood on his hands somehow, in his own mind. Clearly not so much that Batman won't work with him.
Right.
You know, but he has judged himself and found himself wanting, and he doesn't want to put the suit back on if he doesn't have to.
No, this is the young man at the school that is...
No, it turns out later, I learned later that what he, in an earlier appearance in continuity, so maybe, you know, in some issues of something else, I'm not sure, I can't remember precisely where, but previously in the character's continuity there had been a shootout or a gunfight, and he had been unable to protect a civilian.
Oh, okay.
And somebody had gotten shot that way. It had been like, what do you even call it, a ricochet or...
Right.
So as a result, he's kind of gone, I'm not good enough. If I put on the suit, that's a declaration that you're good enough to do this and do it right every time, and I'm not, and I can't. But the very fact that that's what he was thinking about really affected me, and had always sort of drawn me to the guy when I'd seen him. And so then when I went back and I read his original, the first 11 or so issues, you know, it... I suppose that affected what I brought to it, but I really saw him as a character who was constantly sort of trying to determine if he was good enough to please himself. And the fact that he is an Olympian, that he's an athlete, makes a lot of sense to me there, because
right.
I think that you get a psychology that says it's not about whether or not I beat those other guys. It's about whether or not I did my personal best.
Right.
It's always about whether or not I satisfied my own standards of good.
It's kind of like a healthy version of Batman's obsession.
In a lot of ways, yeah. I think that I thought a lot about how there's kind of an interesting spectrum for me where I say, okay, so here's Batman who... doesn't much care for being Bruce Wayne. Bruce Wayne is actually the mask
right.
that he puts on to do his job, right? But he is Batman. And at the other end of it is Superman. And Superman is a mask that Clark Kent puts on.
Right.
You know, he's Clark. That's who he is. And I think he, in many ways, is more comfortable when he's Clark.
That's absolutely my theory.
You know, and so, you know, one of them, the superhero, is the costume, and the other one, the average guy, such as you are when you're Bruce Wayne, is the costume. And I think, you know, I think that Jeff would rather be Jeff than Black Lightning.
Yeah. It seems like,
and at the same time, I think there's a certain liberty for him in Black Lightning. Because when you are, say, a high school principal, when you leave your home as the only local hero your town has ever had as an athlete, you know, when people are looking up to you, and he wants to be Jefferson Pierce. Everybody he knows looks at Jefferson Pierce and says, that guy, he's the finest educator we've got, and he's a terrific athlete. My goodness, look at that guy. And that guy starts becoming, it becomes very hard to keep everybody, your standards for that guy get very, very high.
Right.
And there are ways in which I think that Black Lightning, as a character who can, say, lose his temper once in a while, or be angry.
Take off the kid gloves. You have to take two kids that are fighting and push them apart gently, whereas
right.
Black Lightning can throw them back and say,
what are you thinking?
I
think there's a certain amount of liberty in the costume for him. That doesn't really compare for Superman. I think Superman probably has more liberty when he's Clark, right? He's more free to be who he is than when he's got the cape on. And I think Black Lightning, it at least liberates him to be maybe it's a different kind of emotional quality, I think, for that's the best way I can put it anyway. I think that Jeff Pierce is a guy who keeps a lot inside in order to be there for others. And Jeff and Black Lightning doesn't have to restrain as much, maybe.
Okay, so Superman comic books have often had a thematic of that place that Superman won't even go. It's been suicide slums, it's been third world countries, a lot of writers tend to exploit it, I've seen.
Right.
As we do this interview, issue 2 is coming out, so I haven't read it yet, even though I just looked at it before the interview. But how does Superman enter Black Lightning's world, which is a place that he doesn't usually go, and what does he mean to Jefferson?
In the original material, the conversation that happens when Superman is introduced is along the lines of Black Lightning saying, you know, you're up in the sky and you're too elevated to see what's going on here on the ground in suicide slums, and that's the difference between us. And I found, as I looked through all the material, everything that I could find that dealt with suicide slums, I kept thinking, you know, it just doesn't make sense to me that Superman wouldn't try to fix some of this.
Yeah.
And I felt that for 6 issues to tell a really complete story about a place that is a cesspit in Superman's backyard, there had to be a reason Superman couldn't be the one. And I thought that it was important for the iconic nature of Black Lightning that there be a reason it has to be him. And so I gave it a lot of thought, and I felt that the best and cleanest explanation for why there would be a place that Superman doesn't mess with is that there's a magic element, that there's something that he's susceptible to,
right,
that for some reason Black Lightning can overcome. He's an ordinary human guy, so he is technically no more susceptible to it than we are, or than Superman. So part of the plot is sort of about why he can rise to the occasion, where Superman can only somewhat participate. He's present in the story, but a good deal of it is about why he's not there. That makes it sound like, you know, Black Lightning and why Superman's not him.
Right.
But that's not it. It's more that very early on, I think in the first issue, somebody says not even Superman comes here. And the fact that he doesn't has something to do with what's happened to the emotional state of the people who live there. It's fairly important to them. It's fairly important to the nature of the community that they feel that they've been abandoned by the rest of Metropolis. And so when Black Lightning comes into their lives, it's one of the reasons that he takes on what he does, is that they need somebody so desperately to do this, where no one else who should have or who ordinarily would have has stepped up. You know, the police aren't there. Superman isn't there. Who will help us?
Yeah.
Is sort of the case for the community. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's got a very strong community feel. I look at it and kind of, I was looking at how kind of you've got Black Lightning's area, which is the place that has no hope, and wherever Superman is, there is hope. So if Superman was there, it'd be almost contradictory in a way.
Yeah, and it seemed to me that, you know, one of the things that I'd read over the years when people talked about Black Lightning was always sort of, well, why didn't Superman clean up suicide slums? And I thought, well, if we answer that quickly and move on, or if we answer that as part of our story. You know, because I think, you know, one of the things that makes a hero iconic is that they are part of a bigger picture. Batman needs Gotham and Gotham needs Batman. You know, Superman belongs to Metropolis and Smallville. They are his places, even if he can go everywhere. And I felt like, you know, if suicide slums and Black Lightning are inextricably linked, it's got to be individualized, I think, because otherwise you get sort of a blaxploitation, only Shaft can save the ghetto kind of element, which is really uncomfortable, I think, now.
All right. Well, now I'm making an awkward pause getting my next picture here.
No problem.
Or my next question, but let's see here.
There's no such thing as an awkward pause.
Yes, yes. Not in an organic interview.
No, no, no.
Okay. Now, let's see. The intriguing thing about the Black Lightning series so far, for me, is his relation to his family and how real they, real world they are. I lived in a, kind of a depressed area for a little while, for a couple of years, and I feel like I've met all of these people before. Where did you find the inspiration for them?
It's a good question. I feel, as I think it through, that there are just elements of people I know sort of littered all over. And at the same time, I look at the material and I say a lot of these people are there. If I take Tanner, who is talked about in issue one, who appears in issue two, he's in the original material. And if I did anything with the characters who had pre-existed, it was to simply try and weave them together more and sort of put a spotlight on the humanity that I saw in them on the page already. But I certainly drew in people I know, people I've met. You know, in the original material, Jeff comes back to suicide slums because his mother has died, and or after his mother has died. And I didn't want her to already be dead. I have a personal opposition to all heroes having no family. I thought that because I had all this extra family that's been added to continuity to deal with, I thought, well, if his sister wants to move, then coming home to SEAC to look after mom as one reason makes as much sense. And it lets her be seen as a force in his life. And I thought that he's such, to me, a character who inadvertently, maybe through continuity, has become a lot about family. And so I thought I'd highlight that. And then, too, people who are familiar with my stuff know that if you ask me to write something, it's about 60 seconds before a family enters into it. I almost can't talk about character without talking about family, because I do think that that's the any nature versus nurture questions that we ask about how people got the way they are, it seems to me that you have to look at the family. And I think families also become good microcosms for community and for the world. If you want to say something big about the world, you can say it in a small way about a family and then just explode it. So, you know, there's bits of my family in there. There's bits of my neighbor's family in there. There's probably bits of you in there. You know, everybody.
That's very flattering.
Well, no, it's just, you know, people I meet leak in different ways.
So, where is the series going? Who's the big antagonist? I'm guessing, because I took a look at 2, that it's going to be something to do with the 100, and that, you know, you don't really need to be a genius to figure that out. But where can we expect to the rest of the series to go once Black Lightning is established, as he kind of firmly is by the end of the second issue, right?
Right. Well, it's a year one, right? It's a 6-issue limited. So the mandate for me from DC was that at the end he'd be positioned to become the guy we know now.
Right.
So where it's going in some ways is pretty obvious, I suppose, because mm-hmm. where it's going is he's Black Lightning. At the end of this, he is fully realized as a guy who does this and who will continue to do this. And hopefully, when people look at that last issue, they will say, yeah, I can see how this guy becomes Luther's Secretary of Education. I can see how this guy becomes the one that we met in these other issues. I can see how this guy precedes these other things that are future continuity for me.
Right.
Ideally, I mean, it's sort of like doing a little crossword puzzle or something where you say, well, I want everything to fit together. I often think of it as like writing poetry where, you know, you're building to a nice little couplet at the end that's going to neatly wrap everything up. But it's year one, so it's got to look forward. And what I saw as my arc for this was that Jeff comes into this story wanting to be a guy who takes care of his family. He's a teacher. He wants to change the world in that context. He's very uncomfortable with the idea of having these powers. He was given reason as a child to be afraid of what he might do. And he hadn't had much training in anything but suppressing them. So here's this guy who, by the end of it, needs to not just be Black Lightning, but be comfortable having made that choice. So that's sort of his arc. There's a problem in suicide slums that has to be fixed. And at the same time, you don't want to write a story that says, so he fixes it, and at the end, he's unnecessary.
Right.
He's going to fix a problem and at the same time make a commitment to be there and to fix problems that may have to be fixed again. You get into a funny bind when you're writing superheroes where you want them to be great and awesome, and at the same time their story is done if they can solve every problem. There's no need for them. And that problem is, you know, is the history of comics. How do you keep coming up with reasons for them
to be there?
He can solve a lot of problems. There's some things he can't fix, and for that reason he'll stay.
I think I can say
that without blowing too much.
Yeah, well, you kind of addressed it microcosmically in the second episode mm-hmm. or second issue when you've got the kid cleaning the fountain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kid is obviously a troublemaker, and
mm-hmm.
kind of points to him and he says, "You've got the choice to clean this fountain, be a good person, get on the straight and narrow, or you can get out of here and be a bad
mm-hmm.
person. I'm going to try and influence you to be the good person." But, you know, the idea of kind of suicide slums as a character
mm-hmm.
perpetuating itself kind of means that Black Lightning can be heroic without
losing
its purpose.
And I think that's a lot of it. And yeah, it's a funny thing, too, because I had to look at a lot of the stories about how suicide slums became that. Because I didn't want to just say, well, it's socioeconomically depressed, so everybody's scum. You know, because that's not how it works. It's socio and economic depression is the result of bad acts
yeah.
by bad people, and there are good people living there who can't get out. And a lot of it, again, becomes about a lot of it is about the fact that that's where he's from, that he's of that sort.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I like the way it kind of neatly ties in the political machine almost to a degree in that
mm-hmm.
first issue. I kind of got like a Mayor Daley feel, even though from what I was reading, like the second one's, you know, not as bad as the first. But that whole idea that these people can annihilate the community being in power, and then all of a sudden they're still there,
right.
You know, and no one's ever really done anything about it. That dynastic cycle of politics that
mm-hmm.
you know we haven't experienced recently. Bit. I'm a huge fan of Hopeless Savages, which is one of the ways that I came to know you as a writer, and realizing talking to you now that they're both kind of family stories. I didn't quite catch that connection, which means I'm just dumb as a brick, but that's how I came to be reading Black Lightning, and why I, along with your JSA arc. What are you working on now, other than Black Lightning? What will be coming after this? Will there be a Black Lightning ongoing that potentially springs out of this outside of your own work? And any chance we'll be seeing maybe a new Hopeless Savages soon?
That's a lot of little questions.
Yeah, I'm bad like that.
So the quick answers are, right now I am working on Volume 4 of the Hopeless Savages.
Woohoo!
I have another Oni project that has been waiting for me for a really long time, and I really want to get back to it. That is a departure for me and a challenge for me, and I think that's why I've been postponing it a lot and finding other things that needed to be done, like laundry. But, so that's what I'm working on now. And the rest of the question was... what might be coming out for Black Lightning. Nobody has talked to me about an ongoing. He's certainly gotten more and more screen time in the DCU.
Mm-hmm.
It would be my hope that if this was a well-received mini, they would take that as a reason to consider doing a series for the character, but it's certainly not a conversation anybody's had with me.
Right. The main reason I ask is because it seems like you're setting up a supporting cast that is strong enough to carry a series, if that makes sense.
It would be nice. I think, you know, one of the problems for the project was looking at sort of his current continuity, where you have him saying that he only saw his daughter every other weekend, which
right.
sounds like a divorce.
Right.
And an old continuity where he had no family at all, and then all of a sudden he's got cousins, he's got another daughter, he's got all these people, and what I really wanted to do was kind of make it all coherent. And so hopefully what this will do is both make his long continuity pretty coherent and cohesive, and also explain, like, why haven't they seen a lot of each other when his daughter's 20 and what's going on there. But it's, you know, I think if this fueled more interest in the character, if it made DC feel like there was more reason to support the character and do more with him, I think that would be awesome. He's a great team character, I think. You know, if he stayed in team books, I would be happy to see him there, because I think he's got this great internal moral compass, and he's, I think, a very good character for certain kinds of interactions. You know, you put him on a team and you've got somebody who is not necessarily He's not like a Superman character where people look and say, well, Superman said it, so it must be true.
Right.
And yet, at the same time, he's not nearly so dark as a Batman, you know, and he's got a very natural voice, as opposed to, say, a Martian Manhunter. You know, he's got a kind of regular guy interaction in a lot of ways, and yet he's this very scrupulous and moral guy, and I think that that's an interesting person for a team. But like I said, you know, if they if somebody turned around and said there's enough here to justify a regular series, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think did I answer everything?
Yeah. Absolutely. My questions are convoluted, so. All right, now we get the lightning round.
And
or,
my
you know.
Answers are too, so.
Oh.
No, lightning round. Oh,
yes,
Neil.
Yes, the lightning round. You must answer in 30 seconds. Or no, actually, you can take as long as you want. I'm just,
oh, good.
These are the quick ones. Like, you know, my previous questions have been essays. Like, these have a bunch of little things, but I tend to
write. Is it multiple
choice? No. This is just where you go from, like, college-level deconstruction to, like, what's your favorite color?
Oh.
But no, it's not that bad. Okay, so which of your comic runs are you most proud of?
Right now, this one. I'm really proud of the Hopeless Savages material. I can't do that. You know, this is the newest, and I'm excited about it because it's right now coming out. But I think I have a very soft spot for Golden Streets of Gotham. Because it was my first pitch to mainstream comics as a sort of whole, I made this up, I'm asking you to publish it, and they did. You know, that really blew my mind, and it was a lot of it is about an era in American history that's really important to me, and that I feel fairly passionate about. And so getting to do something with Batman,
right,
even tangentially, that was pretty awesome. And I got to work with some terrific people. But right now, this.
Cool. Yeah, it's the answer to that is typically the current thing that you're working on. Mm-hmm. A lot of people expect to be, well, this thing I wrote in 1973.
Yeah, no, I'm proud of it all. I loved doing the JSA arc, and I was really thrilled with the response to it. It got a lot of positive feedback, and that made me happy. You know, Cinnamon didn't sell well, but every so often I'll be at a show or something and somebody will say, oh, I thought that was awesome, and then I'm proudest of that. You know, it just I'm proud of it all, really.
Cool. Well, let's see, here's the next one. What's your DC dream project? You have the entire DC universe. Do whatever you want.
The entire DC universe, do whatever I want.
That's right.
I am writing Aquaman.
That's right. You're now, well, I wouldn't call you Paul Levitz or Dan DiDio because, you know.
Right. No.
But.
No, I would be writing Aquaman in my dream universe.
Awesome.
But, you know, there's.
Number one or number 47? It's like a million different ones, right?
Well, but that's sort of Aquaman's problem, and maybe I like problem children. I think one of the things is that for as long as I can remember reading superhero comics, I have been fond of Aquaman, and yet every iteration of Aquaman isn't quite my Aquaman.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I want to write him so badly, is that I feel like someday I will write the Aquaman that I'm in love with, who's not quite any of these, but has pieces. You know?
Right.
I suppose, but that's why interesting characters, you know, you get 47 remakes, you know, 47 film versions of Hamlet, because everybody's got a take.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'm not sure that I would call Arthur Hamlet, though there are similarities. but that would be a dream job for me.
Tomorrow, bye. To work again, but run to the supermarket, running hopeful through the aisles. Haven't been this happy in a long time, but not a single jar will smile after all.
All right, Jen. Dan DiDio, great editor or greatest editor?
Great editor. Maybe greatest. Well, Danny O'Neill was pretty awesome, too. But Dan's great.
I'll put you down for great. No, that's Jen is not in trouble for that. That was my
no,
Stephen Colbert
question. And quite frankly, Dan has never actually been my editor.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Awesome.
Dan is oversight, but the editors I've always worked with have been Joan and Rachel and other people. So
awesome.
I don't know what it's like to have him as an actual editor.
So my gotcha question will not get you in any trouble at all.
As an editorial boss, I think he's just fine.
Cool. All right. Why a book every 2 weeks for the Black Lightning series?
My understanding is that they set up all of the year ones, and because there was the Metamorpho and the Huntress, mm-hmm, and the Teen Titans and that whole batch. I think they did a Green Arrow. But when they announced it, they knew they were all going to be 6-issue miniseries. And then sometime after that, I got a call that said they've decided that they're all going to double ship. I don't know why. But I think it may have been that they announced it. It's possible that they announced it and then they said, oh, well, some of these are taking longer than we had really hoped. And so once they do start shipping, we want to get them out fast and turn the whole thing around. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't know. I thought it might have been like a Final Crisis thing because he's prominent. Or...
No, that I had known by the time I was finished writing issue 2, I knew that they were going to double ship whenever it was ready. And then the dates kind of changed on us. Something to do with the Ouija board in the DC office about scheduling.
Okay. Well, here's another one. Have you ever considered writing a novel, given all the comics you've written?
I have considered.
Think you're gonna?
You know, I...
Push.
The longest thing I have written at this point as a single object was a screenplay. And that... The challenge of making a whole complete thing that was that long was energizing and also really, really frustrating. I think the one problem that I have now as a writer because of comics is that I tend to think of everything in small bites.
Right.
And I suppose that if I were to retrain myself to think, well, but an issue is really nothing other than a chapter. So if you can do a whole bunch of issues, you can do a whole bunch of chapters, right? If I could sort of retrain my brain that way, I don't know that I would be intimidated by the idea of a novel as much as I kind of am. I've started a couple. And then I've said, you know, this would be better as a comic. But I've got... there's a project that I have been messing with for a very long time that one of the postponements, the Sony project, one of the postponements was that I went back and forth about saying, is this a comic or is it prose? I don't know. And there are moments where I think maybe it should be prose. Maybe the effort to visually display as opposed to internalize through a narrator, that the way I would have to for a novel, that, you know, is it... Which story is it? But every time I think about it, I'm still picturing it with pictures. So, you know, it's a comic in my head.
So what's a good book that you've been reading lately?
Oh, goodness.
I know, it's just a side question, but I've got to ask a few.
I have been on a retro mystery binge lately. I've been reading a lot of Rex Stout and Earl Stanley Gardner, Perry Mason, and Nero Wolfe.
Cool.
Yeah. Because that's what I like to read for candy when I want to sit and just read something for pleasure. Other good books I've read lately. Golly, you don't get a ton of reading done with kids in the house. But I did recently read, is it that recent? I finally read Wicked, which I had heard talked about and talked about, and, you know, and I tend to have, kind of a phobic reaction to the big star on the front that says international bestseller.
Right.
I think it's the high school outcast in me that once anything becomes too popular, it won't like me and I probably won't like it.
Yes.
But a friend of mine that I really trust said, you know, you've really got to read it. And I'm delighted that I did. I think I thought that it was going to be a sort of a postmodern, we're going to take The Wizard of Oz apart and dissect it because we don't like it. And we think that there's something smarmy and nasty about it, and we're going to expose it for dirty, dirty bad.
Right.
And what I actually felt like it did was that it took more the movie than the bomb books, which I'd read as a kid, but it really took the film that you see and said, you know, what if there's a backstory? And the backstory that's provided is really very engaging. And it's a funny read, and there's a lot in it that is really remarkable because he really does manage to make it so that you could look at the film and say, nothing in this changes. It's a complex and very, very accomplished piece of writing. And I think that the fact that he manages to do the whole book from the perspective of Elphaba, who is the Wicked Witch of the West,
mm-hmm.
Without really casting Dorothy as anything that we don't think of her being from the film, you know, that it's just that everything else that's going on is more complicated than you thought, and it's kind of cool.
Does it follow the movie idea or the Lyman Frank Baum, like with the Kali Da and, you know, this stuff that was a little bit less?
It's more the movie.
Okay.
I would imagine that he read the books, but I don't think he was as interested in the books as he was in the film as the best way to put it, I think, is that what I take away as a novelist who looks at the film as something fairly recent that has entered consciousness with the kind of depth culturally that we get from really old fairy tales or folk
right.
tales. We know it as well as we know Cinderella, even though Cinderella is a 500-year-old folk tale. But we know it from the film. The books have been translated into the sort of iconic nature, the
mm-hmm.
way the film has. And so I think he's more interested in the film, whether he's familiar with the books or not.
Right.
But he's also interested in the idea that we would take a fable like that and sort of treat it as untouchable. And it actually does tie directly into what we're doing when we write comics for hire. When you're got a character like Superman or Black Lightning or Batman,
yeah.
these guys are iconic. And the more so they are, the more that you're dealing not just with, well, here's a guy, here's what he can do, tell a story about him. You're also writing for what people think of the character, what the character means to people. And you can't leave that out. And I think we've all read the things that, where you're like, wow, so this guy calls this a Batman story, but that's not anybody's Batman.
Right.
You know, and I think if they betray the character in some sense, if there's this sense of they've taken that intangible element about the character that leaks out and is meaningful even to people who don't read the character. If they've taken something about that and undone it or betrayed it, that's when people really squawk and you
yeah.
know that something's happened. And I think that was why I didn't want to read Wicked. I thought, oh, it's going to be, you know, some 400 pages of taking the wholesomeness and the genuineness of this movie that people respond to every time, even people who don't want to.
Yeah.
And it's going to just throw that all out. But it doesn't really. it adds to it and makes it meatier, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the task when you take these characters, is to never... First, do no harm. It's a little bit like the Hippocratic Oath. You don't want to hurt the character. You only want to help the character.
Yeah, well, I noticed that.
Or just leave the character alone, even if it's just, you know, so my job here is to move in, tell a story, move out, and the character remains pretty much unchanged. That's not my favorite way to tell a story, but especially with these iconic characters that don't belong to me, that's the least I can do.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the scary thing about writing for that, like whether it's The Wizard of Oz or Superman or Black Lightning,
mm-hmm.
or any of these comic book mediums. Like when I'm interviewing with creators, the thing that I tend to hear mentioned a lot is that that there's this fear, because like, is it Aquaman 1 or is it Aquaman 47? Is it the Richard Donner Superman or is it the Superman of Brian Azzarello? You know,
right?
Which one is it gonna be, and which one is the largest? You know, which one's going to be the most
mm-hmm.
successful as a story, not the most popular, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough because it is such a gamble, and there is so much media out there, especially like with comics or with, you know, like reading a book that is widely critically acclaimed,
mm-hmm.
like Wicked. You got to say which one's going to be a Da Vinci Code, which is like, you know, a poof novel, but you're just like, woo! And I don't mean proof in the British sense. Don't be sending me letters. Just like a fluff novel that means nothing, or if it's going to be something that's going to actually impact your life, and it's always, it seems to be like a crapshoot with popular stuff. I have that, I share
yeah.
that urge, because you never know. It's like is this new book that's written by X comic book star
mm-hmm.
going to be brilliant, or is it going to be something that's not derivative of the original work at all and is a vanity project to
yeah.
stroke the creator's ego, you know?
Well, and it's a tricky thing too, because I think with comic characters, you know, there are certain things that, you know, the characters that last, that really have a skeleton and legs and, you know, they stand up whether we touch them or not, you know, and I'm going to use Superman again as the example because he's the example.
Right, he's a proto-hero.
You know, you can, it's why Elseworlds, when they work, things like that are awesome, because what they force you to realize is that the character has something there that is there no matter where you put him, no matter when you put him. You can, you know, like, if you can strip away everything but this essence, and if that essence is there, it's Superman.
Right.
And how these characters have entered into our consciousness is such that you can tell so quickly whether or not somebody has that essence there. And I think that when we sit down to write them, I shouldn't say obligated, because, you know, if I ever got my Aquaman dream job, for instance,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I would read every single issue of everything that ever had him in it. I'm not sure I would. I'm not sure I would bother. I would read a lot. I would read more than I already have, and I've read a lot. But at some point I would sit down and I would say, okay, I've let all of this sort of pour through me like I'm a colander. And when all the water has washed away, when all the liquid material has gone, what are the solids that are left? What's the base material? You know, or maybe you put it in a beaker, like in a chem lab, and try to reduce it down to,
right.
You know, at some point that's what you're always doing with these characters.
Yeah, because you can't read 800 issues.
Yeah, and everybody's got their own take, because everybody's a different make of sieve. You know,
mm-hmm.
everybody's bringing their own stuff to it. Everybody reads these things differently. And that's part of the wonderfulness of it, in a way, because they are much more a community project than a novel.
Well, that leads right into one of my other questions.
Okay.
What was the research process like for Black Lightning?
Well, I had read quite a bit, but it had been in the way back, like, I didn't know I was going to be writing it when I was reading it, so, you know, I had to refresh my memory on some of that. And then that weekend when Dan told me to pitch, I'd found probably seven of the 10 issues that that Tony Isabella wrote, or 11, and then I'd found the Denny O'Neill issue from before they canceled the original series. It had a very short run. But I'd found more than half of the original run. And I'd read that material, and then I had given a very loose pitch to Dan, and he'd said, well, you know, go home and put something more formal together for Joan Hilty, who was going to be the editor, and we'll see what we think. And so it wasn't approved at that point, but he seemed fairly confident in me, and I think that was actually another attraction to the project. He was very based, I think, on the Golden Streets book, which he had told me he liked. He seemed to think that he wanted me for this, and I can't help being flattered. It's always nice to be wanted.
Right.
But I went back home, and then DC was able to send me Xeroxes from their archives of the issues I couldn't find. So I didn't have color on those, but I had everything else. And at that point, I read them and reread them, and then read there was a run that started, I think, in 1997, where they gave him a second title. And Tony came back for that, and Trevor, right? Yeah. Am I thinking the right name? But so I read that material all again and again and again, and at some point I kind of sat down and said, okay, well, then who is he? And to me, the core of the guy, you take him out of time, you take him out of place, he is first and foremost an educator. I think that one of the things that is key about him as a character is that he would rather not need to be a superhero. I don't think I would quite call him reluctant, but if he takes no joy in beating people up.
Yeah, it seems he'd be happy being a principal.
Yeah, he would be happy having a normal life. And being necessary is... he is going to step up and do the job. I think in a lot of ways he's got something in common with soldiers. He would love to be unnecessary, but he's going to do his job perfectly as long as it is necessary.
Right.
You know, but he's got an enormous amount of integrity. And I think the other thing, and one of the reasons that I took in the original series, you said you weren't super familiar with it. In the original series, he gets his powers from the belt that's part of his costume. And it was only in later continuity that they said, no, he absorbed the powers from his belt and now they're his. And when I was going back and trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do with that? I said, you know, we've got these daughters who have been born with native powers. First thing is that it's simpler to just say, no, he always had the powers. But then you say, well, then why didn't he use them? And one of the things that I thought about was, you know, we don't talk a lot about how often we are frightened at the idea of our own difference. But certainly I'm familiar with the idea that you don't necessarily want people to know you're different in any way. We spend a lot of our lives trying to be just like everybody else. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about the kind of self-control the character has always seemed to have. This incredible composure. And I thought, well, maybe what it is about him is that he spends his young life trying to sort of push back this power that to his mind is dangerous, possibly somehow inherently bad. And it takes a set of circumstances to make him see this is actually a good thing about him. And in many ways, I think it becomes a metaphor for the character. to when we were talking about once Cully was on board and he was seeing the outline, and we were talking a lot about the looks of the people, and you know, and I would send him like, I saw this photograph of this building, and maybe is this a good reference? And we're on the phone talking about all kinds of things, and I think it was him who said that he thought that it was very interesting the way. He said, I really like how you handled the race thing so subtly.
Huh.
And I said, the race thing so subtly? And what he was sort of suggesting was that, and I think he's right, that, you know, historically one of the things that African American men have had to deal with is that sort of scary black man thing.
Yeah.
And
calling people turkey and fool.
Well, and it's a complicated history, because what you get, and certainly I've talked to plenty of men who've experienced this. I think it's a fairly, I don't want to overgeneralize, but I think it is commonplace for African American men to have the experience of not wanting to seem anything but proud, not wanting to seem less competent, and at the same time not recognizing that if they are too proud and too confident, they start becoming the scary black man. And it's
catch 22.
It's a really problematic place to be. And it is, it's something that is so, it's a challenging thing to talk about. Because those conversations are always so loaded. I mean, we've seen it in the last year with the election.
Yeah.
That, you know, the best, most well-intentioned people still find themselves going, well, you know, these are complicated conversations to have, because you can so easily, inadvertently, either reveal something about yourself that you didn't want people to see, reveal something you didn't even know was there, project something that isn't there inadvertently. You know, there's so many complicated things.
You know, you could reveal an ignorance, like saying he speaks so well as a compliment.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. And one of the things that I think Cully was looking at was that the specific, discreet, literal power that he has is something he has been tempted to hide in order to seem less threatening.
Right.
In order to not be threatening, in order to be safe for himself, for his community, for his family. And it scares him a little bit.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And I think that what Cully was pointing to was that, yeah, you know, that's actually probably very familiar for a lot of guys.
Yeah.
You know, just on the basis of how you present yourself walking down the street.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting because I hadn't really been thinking about it that way when I planned it out. But once it was pointed out to me, it very quickly sort of just absorbed into the way we thought about the project.
Yeah. Well, it might have been subconscious too.
Oh, sure.
It could easily have been.
You
can see it in the principal even. Like the way he's got to be strong and firm, and yet he's kind of tender with the kids.
Right.
He holds himself back, you know, and that comes with any degree of when you're given power.
Right.
But it's especially sensitive given that he's got to deal with a lot of people who... It's like an alpha dog situation when you're impoverished, and that's black and white. You know?
Right.
It's like
exactly.
You've got to push yourself to be, you know, the chief of your station because your station is so low, and it results in so many people, you know, butting heads and not wanting to talk.
And I think too that, you know, one of the things that's very definitely going on with the character for me is that, and I saw this in the original material as well as in. I saw it in the original material. It made it very important for me to make sure that it made its way into the year one, was that if you're the sort of person who's turning to others on a regular daily basis and saying, who are you going to be? What choice are you going to make? It means that that's a conversation you're having with yourself daily.
Right.
Every single day. And I think that's the core of the character and the thing that makes him iconic in his own right. Because Superman and Batman, the thing about them is they kind of know who they are.
Yeah, there's no real question.
in very different ways. They don't. Neither one of them wakes up every day and says, "Well, who am I?"
Right. Should I have taken my family to this strange city and done this thing?
Exactly. Yeah. You know. But I think for this guy, I think one of the things about him is that's a question that he answers in an affirmative and positive way every day.
Well, it leads to suitable complexity so that you get a guy who is a hero at his core and yet can work with a Luthor later, because he's got to work with the devil, you know.
It's an opportunity to do something good,
right?
Yeah, and maybe keep an eye on somebody dangerous.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
Anyhow.
Now that we've talked about socioeconomics, the black and white paradigm, and what it takes to be a good person, I want to know how Black Lightning takes a shower without killing himself.
He can turn it on and off.
Oh, okay. Well, that was easy. All right, another one of my smart-ass questions. Well, obviously, you pretty much answered the question of who your favorite comic book hero is of all time.
Yeah.
If I'm guessing right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
But Jefferson Pierce is up there now, too. I wouldn't have said it, you know, when I took on this project, I would not have said Black Lightning. He's one of my favorites. I didn't know him well enough to really have a feeling about him. At this point, I would say he is in the running for one of my top five.
Well, you get to know somebody when you write him. Even though they're imaginary. People don't believe me that you talk to them in your head.
Oh, God.
Scary, isn't it?
Yep.
Cool.
Especially when you ask them what they want for dinner and you realize that that's entirely irrelevant.
That's right. All right, last lightning round question and probably conclusion of the interview. What comics do you read on a regular basis, and what are you enjoying right now? I know you said that, you know, reading is strange with kids.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing because right this instant, when the comp box comes, because Greg gets a comp box from DC, I certainly don't rate my own, but when the comp box comes, I read most of the Superman titles. I read most of the Batman titles. I always read JSA. I've been reading Wonder Woman. I've been what else have I been reading?
You check out any indie books or anything like that?
Oh, well, sure. I read a lot of the Oni material. I think the biggest curse for me now is not so much time to read as time to go to the comic book store and browse, because I'm usually running around behind somebody much smaller than me going, stop touching that. So I tend to read what gets handed to me. I finally got to read Fun Home not long ago, and that blew me away. If I ever had it in me to write something half that good, I'd die a happy woman. I think that was such a remarkable piece of work. And I would recommend it to anybody. My son and I have been reading Mouse Guard, and that's, I think, a great, great series. What else is there that I've been enjoying? Well, my daughter and I read Owly.
Yeah, Owly's
and I read Amelia Rules with my son, who is, he's got a really broad range of interests, but we read Akiko together, and we just got him the Great Big Fat Bone book, the huge collection.
Right.
And so I got to reread a bunch of Bone. That was awesome.
Nice.
But yeah, actually, the things that have been getting read by me most has been stuff that I find myself picking up because one of the kids left it lying around, or they'll bring it to me because it's a little more, it's a little above them, and they'll want me to help them through it. And then, you know, every once in a while, our son will want to check out something that's a little darker than he wants to do alone. So we'll sit and I'll read it with him. It's much easier now that when he was five, he wanted us to read comics to him. And this is actually funny, because I saw on your screen that you were thinking about asking how I got interested in comics in the first place.
Yeah.
When I was a kid in Fresno, California, on Sunday mornings, there was a local radio station that had a program for maybe a half an hour on Sunday mornings, where college kids, I think from either the broadcasting program or like broadcast journalism, or maybe it was from the theater department, would come into the radio studio and they would read the Sunday funnies to you. They'd act them out. So they'd have like three or four kids at the mics. You know, I say kids now. At the time, they were these incredibly sophisticated, mature people, because I was four and five. But you could lie on the floor in your living room and they'd act out the funnies. And it was hysterically funny. And it was a really profound memory for me. And then when I got older, I was a spin rack kid. You know, I would get like Casper or Wendy or things like that. I was a big Archie fan for a while. And then from that, I found all of the mid-70s, like, scary comics. Anything with that sort of dripping font lettering was
right.
Always really good. I would get, like, Weird Tales and things like that and bring those home. And very frequently, I would get them on the basis of cool covers that freaked me out. And then I would bring them home and not read them. I kid you not, there is an issue in my father's house to this day of Jonah Hex that I've never looked inside, because I loved the cover and yet it scared the snot out of me. And I was never able to open it. And at this point, I've convinced myself that what is in that book is as scary as anything in the Necronomicon. I've never been able to read it.
You open it up, it'll suck your hand in.
I don't know. I just know that the cover was... and all it was a close-up of him with that creepy
lip
string
thing,
and he was saying something like, you know, "and you, damn you to hell," or something, you know, I don't know, but it got me. But yeah, that's sort of my trip into comics. And the reason I say all that is that it's very hard to actually just read a comic alone to a kid.
Right.
Because you're like, and now this person says, and now this person says, and here's a caption, and that means it's in this person's head. And it disrupts all the things that a comic is, because you're supposed to be sort of soaking all this in and doing that work yourself.
Right. It's kind of like a movie or TV show. If you're sucked out, it's hard to get the emotion.
It is a little, I would imagine, like, I don't know what it's like to go from being, from having complete hearing to needing closed captions.
Mm-hmm. It's probably takes a whole lot out of it.
I would imagine it's a strange transition, and one feels a little bit like one's being sort of a translator.
Well, there's a profound moment there when you're learning to read or learning to digest reading.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it like I didn't know that you could read silently when I was a kid. I would read out loud, and then there's that moment when you realize, oh, I can think it in my head, and then all of a sudden you're emotionally sucked right in.
Right.
You know, and teaching a kid that's got to be impossible.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not impossible. We all do it.
Learn
it.
It's got to be like
so
daunting.
Impossible. But reading comics out loud to the kids was always really frustrating, because they would want it, and I would sit there saying, "Well, it's ruining the book for me, kid. I don't want it." You know, it was really, really frustrating. And so when he became able to read to himself, then what happened is that we'd sit and like look at the page together, and he'd say, "Why is he saying that?"
Oh,
and he just
pokes
the balloon, and then that way we can enjoy it. It's much easier to enjoy it together, because
right.
now it's more a conversation about the thing. as opposed to me actually trying to say, you know, I can't do Lex Luthor's voice, damn it. You know, I'm never going to be able to, and I'm terrible with accents, so, you know.
Yeah, does he still have an Australian accent? Oh, wait, no, that's
know.
A continuity issue. No, I'm kidding. All
no
right.
Idea what you're talking about.
Well, then we'll close on one final question.
Okay.
Since you mentioned Archie. Betty or Veronica? That's the toughest question in all comic book.
I'd rather know Betty. I'd rather be Veronica.
Awesome. See, I
but
have
I'm
the perfect
not either
answer.
One.
I have the perfect guy answer. Betty and Veronica.
Well,
and
yeah.
On that note, thank you, Jen, very much. I'm going to say goodbye now and do a virtual handshake.
Ha! My joke sucked. Well, as you can see, Jen was very obliging, and the Superman homepage wishes to thank her for her kind words. Now you need to do your part if you enjoyed the interview. Get your butt out there. Buy the Black Lightning series. It's rad. I tend not to do interviews very often, and it's only with people that I really, really want to support because they're doing something that I think is great, and Black Lightning gets my highest endorsement as the most critical reviewer on planet Earth. I mean, you gotta get out there. You gotta give it a shot. It's got Superman in it. It's got really great dynamics. It's one of the strongest comics I've seen in a while. So, give it a shot. Thanks, Jen.